where you are assigned?
I'm the commanding officer of the U.S. Coast Guard Marine Safety Office in Valdez, Alaska.
And do you have any other duties besides those of commanding officer?
I'm also the captain of the port, the officer in charge of marine inspection, and the pre-designated federal on-scene coordinator for Prince William Sound.
Mr. Chairman, at this time I would like to introduce two exhibits, one which we will call 13A, which is a letter from the commanding officer of Marine Safety Office, Valdez, to the commandant, offices of M and OAN, the subject of reorganization and redesignation of the Coast Guard activities in Valdez, Alaska. The second one, which we'll call 13B, is a memorandum from the commanding officer of Marine Safety Office, Valdez, to the commandant, and the subject is the ANFPS-121 radar, a 6 months evaluation of that radar. It's dated April 3rd, 1985, I believe it says.
Mr. Clucelli, do all the parties have these two exhibits?
Yes, they have been given exhibits. Commander McCall, Mr. Kacharian will ask you further questions.
Commander, what other marine safety assignments have you had?
I was a marine inspector in New York from 1969 to 1972. I was the executive officer at the Marine Safety Office in Albany, New York from 1973 to 1977. From 1977 till 1981, I was assigned to Coast Guard headquarters, Washington, D.C., in the Merchant Marine Technical Division. And from 1981 till 1985, I was the executive officer at the Marine Safety Office in Memphis, Tennessee. And then from 85 till present, the CO in Valdez.
What is the purpose and the mission of the MSO at Valdez?
The Marine Safety Office in Valdez has the responsibility of conducting commercial vessel safety activities, inspections, investigations, port safety and security for the Prince William Sound area, and marine environmental protection for the Prince William Sound area. And the Vessel Traffic Center and the Vessel Traffic Service are operated under the guise of the port safety operation.
Is the Vessel Traffic Service one of the primary missions of your office?
Yes, it is.
Could you briefly describe the different departments in your MSO?
MSO Valdez is divided up into four departments: the Marine Safety Department, the Operations Department, Administrative Department, and Public Works Department. The Vessel Traffic Center falls within the Operations Department.
And what about the pollution control response?
The pollution control response is in the Marine Safety Department.
Can you give me just a rough number of the ranks and rating numbers of the people in the different departments?
Well, there's 37 billets allotted to MSO Valdez. Right now we have, I believe, 44 personnel assigned. In the Marine Safety Department, we have a warrant officer as an inspector. We have a chief gunner's mate as Port Safety Department chief, and three petty officers as port safety investigators and pollution investigators. In the Vessel Traffic Service, we have a lieutenant as an operations officer, a chief's billet for a assistant operations department head, various radarman billets, and three GS-9 civilian vessel traffic controllers. The military radarmen are vessel traffic watchstanders. In the other section of the operations department is the radio side, and we have radio men for that part of the operation.
And your public works, what is that?
Public works is, we have 28 units of housing that we maintain, in addition to the snow removal activities, our own groundskeeping equipment. So we have, there's a warrant officer in charge of that with a chief MK, chief machinist, damage controlman, and engineering petty officers, and several non-rated personnel.
And your personnel or administrative services department?
The admin department has a lieutenant as the department head, a first-class yeoman, and a second-class storekeeper. Oh, also in the operations department are two electronics technicians for maintaining the communications and radar equipment that we have.
Do you have regular scheduled staff meetings to discuss the operation of your unit?
We have what we call payday meetings every payday, twice a month, where we have an all-hands get-together to discuss things that are affecting the unit during the last 2 weeks. And those payday meetings are followed by training sessions for assigned personnel. We have officers' meetings. They used to be scheduled every Monday, but we have them floating now as the need arises. We don't have a firm schedule on the officer call meetings anymore.
Could you describe how you perceive your leadership style? Are you autocratic, laissez-faire, somewhere in between? How do you describe yourself?
I describe my style as allowing individuals to express themselves and be as creative as possible within the structured regime of the military organization.
I'd like to talk about pilotage. Can you provide some historical background of the pilotage in Prince William Sound since the Alyeska Terminal opened in Valdez?
Yes. In 1977, when the tanker operations commenced, the pilot station for vessels entering Prince William Sound was at Cape Hinchinbrook. Soon thereafter, the pilots would board vessels entering Prince William Sound at Cape Hinchinbrook and ride them into Port Valdez. Around 1979, I believe, they had an incident where one of their pilot boats, the Blue Moon, sank while attempting to get a pilot on board. No one was injured or lost. But from that point on, the pilots were very reluctant to attempt to board tankers at Cape Hinchinbrook. And in 1980, the commanding officer at the Marine Safety Office then, James Woodall, issued the first of several Captain of the Port orders, which modified or permitted vessels to enter Prince William Sound past the designated pilot station at Cape Hinchinbrook to a newly designated pilot station at Rocky Point.
Okay. Were these, was this a Coast Guard federal pilot license requirement area? Or?
For U.S. vessels on coastwise voyages, yes, sir.
Normally, U.S. tank ships under enrollment with a crew member with a federal pilot's license aboard does not require a state pilot. So then, why do state pilots handle the tank ships proceeding in and out of Valdez?
You mean from the pilot station into the dock?
Yes.
I believe that's an agreement or a contractual agreement between Alyeska and the owner companies that They will not accept any vessels at their berth unless they are under the operational control or oversight of a licensed state pilot.
Originally, when Valdez Terminal was open, did the Coast Guard expect that all those tank ships loading the North Slope crude, were they expected to be all U.S. vessels?
I'm not positive whether they expected it or not. I know for a fact they were not wholly U.S. Flag vessels. There are several foreign flag vessels that come to call at Valdez.
How are these U.S. flag vessels allowed to trade from Alaska to the States?
U.S. flag or foreign flag?
A foreign flag, I'm sorry.
The foreign flag vessels have been granted a Jones Act exemption to go to the, I believe it's the Hess refinery in the Virgin Islands, U.S. Virgin Islands. They go around South America. Their voyage is normally in a range of 60 days, where most U.S. flag vessels' voyages are averaging 30 days.
Can you give me a figured number of the number of foreign flag vessels that carry crude from Valdez?
You mean the average number of visits?
Yeah, average number of visits a year or a month?
I'd say we're averaging maybe one a week. I can get more detailed figures and make those available to you.
Okay. Do you know if any of these foreign flag vessels carry American licensed officers with pilotage aboard?
I don't believe so.
Can you look at Exhibit 9D that concerns the Captain of the Port Order 1-80? Do you have that up there? Now, what was the purpose of that order, do you know?
The original purpose of this order was to be a short-term solution to the pilotage question. Commander Woodall issued this with the belief that within a year or so, new pilotage regulations would be published, making the Rocky Point area the pilot station for Prince William Sound, due to the problem with the sea state and the problem of pilots getting on board at Cape Hinchinbrook.
Exhibit 9E is your memo that canceled that order. What was the reason for the, or reasons for canceling?
Okay, the Captain of the Port order that was, the Exhibit 9D, 1980, was reissued again in 1981 because of the problems or delay in getting pilotage regulations amended. From 1981, the last published date of the Captain of Port order, until I came on the scene in Valdez, we were operating under that 1981 issue of the Captain of Port order, which I felt was inappropriate due to the length of time that it had elapsed. So I used what I felt was the authority within the Vessel Traffic Service regulations to cancel the Captain of the Port order, but put into place or continue into place the same effect while we were waiting for these regulations, the new pilotage regulations, to be issued. So the content and the effect of that Captain of the Port order is still in place. It is just being operated on under a different mechanism using the VTS rules as opposed to a Captain of the Port order.
All right. Exhibit 9A is that Federal Register that was a notice of proposed rulemaking that concerned that pilotage. Was that in effect affirming your memo change?
Yes.
Have you any projection when that those pilotage rules will come out?
Prior to the Exxon Valdez casualty, those regulations were still on hold, being a part of a larger nationwide pilotage regulatory project. Since the Exxon Valdez casualty, there has been a new proposed regulation for pilotage in Prince William Sound issued.
Would the those going back to that proposed rule in 88, 9A, Exhibit 9A, would that have reduced the requirement to having only one officer in the wheelhouse with no pilot endorsement?
The one officer in the wheelhouse, the dual officers in the wheelhouse was a constraint put on non-pilotage vessels in that Captain of the Port order and carried through. When the pilot station was relocated or would be relocated to, in 1988, the Rocky Point area, yes, that would, in fact, reduce that requirement for having two.
Okay. Do you know what the new proposed regulations are for the pilotage in Prince William Sound?
It makes mention of the vicinity of Bly Reef, the Bly Reef buoy pilot station.
So
it moves it back out a little bit, yes.
Okay, so it moves it down from Rocky Point down to Bly Reef?
Bly Reef, right. The point, the location where the captain of the port order required non-pilotage vessels to pick up a pilot at.
Does that reimpose a two officers in the wheelhouse, do you know?
I don't believe so.
Can you explain the agreement for the optimum track line in the Narrows? How it was established and its purpose?
To the best of my understanding, as it's been explained to me, that was worked on during the first year or two that the BTS was operating, 1977 and on to 1978, with between the BTS and the pilots to come up with a agreed upon track line that would be adhere to avoid any possibilities of confusion between what the VTS would see on their radar and what the tankers were actually doing. They would adhere to that track line, and if something was off that track line, it would key the VTS or the watchstander to contact the vessel to see what was, you know, what was happening. Was there a problem, or were they just not realizing they were off the track line?
Is there any enforcement authority, such as monetary penalties or action against administrative action against a license for a disregard of that optimum track line?
Not in so many words. What we have done in the past, several times since I've been here, and I think prior to my arrival, occasionally a pilot will drift off that line, and we will contact him on the radio and follow it up with some written correspondence. Just alerting him to the fact that he was off the track line and requesting that he adhere to the agreed-upon line. And that's, in the past, that has been sufficient to resolve the problem. So we have never had to do any enforcement other than just some correspondence.
You mentioned that the pilots now are picked up further down in the Valdez arm. Where did that change come from? From your office or Washington?
You're referring to what is going on right now?
Right, with the pilots.
After the Valdez casualty?
Right.
The pilots are getting off at the Bly Reef pilot station right now under the emergency order issued by the state of Alaska.
In Exhibit 13A, your letter concerning the reduction in force and change of operations of the MSO, do you know what happened to that recommendation?
The recommendation was approved up the line, but got put on hold because of Coast Guard budget reductions and reorganizations.
Did you lose any personnel and gain civilians as a result of that letter or that you sent in?
No, you've got two separate issues. One is the civilianization. We transferred or exchanged three quartermaster billets for three GS-9 civilian, as they are described, vessel traffic controllers. And then in a separate time frame, a little later, we lost watch officer billets and one BTS watch stander billet later on. But the civilianization didn't detract from the numbers. We just gave up quartermaster billets and acquired civilian watch stander billets.
You lost five lieutenants or three lieutenants?
We lost a total of four lieutenant billets and one watch stander, one RD, radarman watch stander, in 1977.
Okay. With the loss of those officers, were your responsibilities or operations changed in any way?
The responsibilities, tasks of the office were not changed at all. It required, obviously, realignment within the office and retasking and expanding of the duties of many people.
Now I'd like to get into the pollution situation, the response situation. Obviously, when you received the phone call, the Exxon Valdez situation was going to turn into a major or a potential major pollution incident, and you went into the office to supervise the response. What do you normally do in a minor spill or a medium spill incident? You rush into the office and take control? Or?
If it's a minor spill, more than likely not. More than likely, they'll either call myself or the XO and keep us posted on the progress of the response. Since medium spills are very rare in Valdez, more than likely I would have come into the office to see what was being done, what the progress was, and definitely for a major oil spill.
Again, with the Exxon Valdez incident, after you arrived at the MSO, we understand you got on the radio with Captain Hazelwood. Can you relate to us what you discussed?
When I spoke to him on the radio, I was concerned that the vessel would not be put in any more danger than it already was, and that he assessed the situation before doing anything unrecoverable.
Did you give him any advice about trying to stay where he is until he evaluated things, or try to get off the rocks? Or?
Basically, yes. I felt that I didn't. I think my actual words were, I'm probably telling you the obvious, but I felt I had to just remind him of the fact that obviously as a master, he's the ultimate one responsible for the safety of his vessel, but he should ensure that he has as much control over the situation as possible and not do anything that he could not recover from. Had it been a different vessel, I might have used stronger words. A different vessel that I was not familiar with the operation of, like we are within the TAPS trade.
A vessel not in the TAPS trade. After your executive officer was aboard the Valdez, and you were asked to get someone out there for a toxicology test, what did you discuss with Trooper Fox about trying to comply with your XO's request?
Okay, my initial thought when Lieutenant Commander Falkenstein assessed the situation and advised me of it, was to attempt to contact the Alaska State Trooper, Jim Alexander, who we had worked with previously on discussing this type of situation and also on some other minor cases. And he was unavailable. So my next point of contact was Trooper Fox. And I called him up at home and woke him up and explained the situation to him and asked him to respond if he could. And he said he would swing by the local police station and grab the breathalyzer kit and head on out. Now, I understand when he got out there, he didn't have it. He was in a deep sleep, and I think the phone conversation may have been a little fuzzy. But he arrived on scene without the breathalyzer kit, which prompted the next set of phone calls to get someone else out.
Okay, you said you used Trooper Thompson on other minor cases. Did that involve any of the tank ships and the taps trays?
That was Alexander, but no, it wasn't. It was a recreational vessel.
As the federal on-scene coordinator for Prince William Sound, you're required to make notifications when you're involved or you hear of an oil spill. Who are you required to call?
Well, we notified the 17th Coast Guard District Commander Rome. We notified Washington, D.C. headquarters, National Response Center. And then, of course, we contacted Alyeska.
Any state agencies?
Well, DEC. Well, actually, we didn't call DEC. DEC, it was 50-50. I think we were calling them as they were calling us. So it was.
Now, did you make all the necessary calls that you're required to make?
Yes, we did.
Can you relate the situation with the dispersant use during Friday, March 24th? How you became involved in it? What were the problems?
Well, the first discussion or the first thoughts I had about dispersants were about, I guess 0045, 0050, 1250 that morning when I phoned Alyeska. I mentioned to the Marine supervisor on duty that night, Mr. David Barnum, that I was attempting to get in contact with Larry Shire. I mentioned to him that you probably ought to start thinking about getting dispersants up here. We may want to use them. And I think the next discussion that I had with anyone concerning dispersants was when I spoke to Mr. Harvey Borgen from Exxon at about 4:25 Valdez time. We talked about several things, one of which was dispersants. I mentioned to him that I had contacted Alyeska, and Alyeska had already or was in contact with the company down in Arizona, and there was. The gears were turning in as far as getting equipment up to Valdez for the use of dispersants. I mentioned to him that the oil right now, well, the ship is in a zone 2 and the oil is in a zone 2, but it'll probably get into a zone 1 where I have pre-designated on scene, I mean where I have pre-authorization to use dispersants. I also mentioned that, as you know, use of dispersants is very time critical. We've got about a 24-hour window from the data I have to where their effectiveness is best. And that was about the last conversation I had until about, I think, 8:30 or so in the morning. We received a request for dispersant use from Alyeska, faxed to us from their side of the port to ours.
Okay, so the Valdez at the time was in the non-pre-approved area, is that correct?
At that time, it's the way the program is laid out, routinely or for a large portion of the year, that area where the Valdez was, all the way on into Port Valdez, is a Zone 1, an area where I have pre-authorization to use it. However, from March 1st until October 15th, that area becomes a Zone 2. Where prior to use, we need to get the concurrence of the state of Alaska, DEC, and EPA.
I noticed some from conversations or testimony that you wanted to make a test before you use the dispersant. What was the reason for that?
There's been a lot of talk about test, trial applications, blanket use, whatever. What I was trying to determine was, given the conditions that we had, oil on the water, water state, sea state, wind state, whether or not dispersant would be a viable option. So we did a trial application later on that day to see whether or not the core exit 9527, that's the dispersant, would have a positive effect on the oil as it was at that time. And that was, by the time we actually did the test, it was late Friday afternoon, early Friday evening, with a helicopter dispersant spraying bucket with 300 gallons of dispersant in it. And we made several passes and sprayed the dispersant on the oil. And there appeared to be no positive effect. I think part of that was probably due to the thickness of the oil that we had, still had. It was still pretty thick. That was, by the time we actually did the test, it was late Friday afternoon, early Friday evening, with a helicopter dispersant spraying bucket with 300 gallons of dispersant in it. And we made several passes and sprayed the dispersant on the oil. And there appeared to be no positive effect. I think part of that was probably due to the thickness of the oil that we had, still had. It was still pretty thick on the surface, and there was very little water surface energy, no wave action. And so that was the only test we did on Friday.
If 24 hours is critical, why did you wait and make the test then?
Well, we didn't really wait. It took time for the dispersant spraying equipment to arrive at the terminal. When it did arrive, there were some repairs or add-on items that had to be made to it. Alyeska's personnel had to weld some brackets onto the bucket. And then we all just got up in the spotter helicopter and witnessed the test. I don't think there was any real delay in doing it. Authorization was, I think, granted by the RRT. Well, we discussed about it with the RRT around noon, and I think official blessing or such was given around 3 o'clock in the afternoon by myself. But
that was my next question. Other than the dispersant discussions with the people in the RRT, what else did you discuss?
Well, we discussed the in situ burning of the oil. And also we discussed the progress of the spill and the response, and the resource agencies expressed concern about certain locales and areas for protection.
The RRT is advisory, is that correct?
That's correct.
And I understand the decision is to take any action is still up to you as the OSC. Can you override their advice? And if you do, how could you handle that with criticism or whatever? Is it really a big problem to override any advice you get from the RRT?
Well, I wouldn't use the word override. I would say, they provide information that we evaluate, and then basically based on their input, I make a decision. There's no real overriding as such going on.
If you would have used the dispersant and the conditions were not favorable for the use, where the dispersant wouldn't mix with the water, would that be more harmful for the environment?
Well, it would be introducing another, foreign object into the water.
You said you discussed in situ burning. Were you able to make any tests or do any burning that in that first 24-hour period?
No, not in that first 24-hour period.
A few final questions. In our previous interviews, you said that Alyeska's response was a little slow. Did you have any reason as OSC to take over the cleanup activities in the first 24 hours?
No. There wouldn't have been anything that I could have done. There were no other resources readily available to put in place than those that were already either in place or en route. So there was no benefit to be derived from me taking it over.
Do you know how many gallons of dispersant Alyeska had?
I heard it was quoted yesterday as 2,500. I thought they had 3,500, but not,
Do you have any estimate of how much you would have really needed to really handle that spill?
It's been calculated that if you had 250,000 barrels of oil spilled, 10 million gallons, you would probably, and at a dispersant rate of 1 to 20, which is what the original permit request specified, you'd need about 500,000 gallons of dispersant for an approximate 35% effectiveness.
Now, if the Exxon Valdez had been a foreign tank ship loaded with North Slope crude, would your response have been any different? Is this the foreign ship still responsible for its cleanup?
Oh, yes. And Alyeska would have provided the initial response. And the owner of the cargo, whichever company that was, may have done a similar action as Exxon coming in and taking over, but I couldn't say for sure.
The other day when Mr. Flint was here, the assistant merchant vessel personnel civilian in Coast Guard headquarters, he said that there is a regulation that a watch officer must have the opportunity to have 6 hours rest in the previous 12 hours before going on watch. Are you aware of this rule?
Yes, I've heard of that.
Have you ever had any requests or complaints from any of the people or any of the crew members at tank ships at Alyeska they weren't getting enough rest before proceeding out?
No, I never.
I have no further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Conjurian. Mr. Johnson, please.
Good morning, Commander McCall. This morning I'm going to be asking you questions on the vessel traffic service. Would you please tell us the purpose and mission of the Prince William Sound Vessel Traffic Service?
The main purpose of vessel traffic service is to provide navigational assistance information to vessels that would not normally be readily available to them.
Could you elaborate a little bit further?
Well, the easiest way, I think, to explain the way the Valdez or the VTS Prince William Sound works is for vessels coming into Prince William Sound, into Port Valdez, they have to make a transit through Valdez Narrows, narrow portion of water, and then make a hard right turn into the port. Now, the radar and navigational equipment that is on board major vessels, tankers and such, can provide the ship with a lot of information as far as what's ahead of them, what's around them. But what it can't do is it can't see around that right-hand turn. They can't see into the port. So the VTS in Prince William Sound has two radar sites, one located in the port and one located at Potato Point. And the main, most important piece of information we feed to the tankers is based on those radar fixes in Port Valdez and right outside Valdez Narrows, what ships are coming that they may, if they didn't have that information, end up meeting in Valdez Narrows. So we, by the information that we have, we prevent ships, two ships going opposite directions, from meeting in Valdez Narrows, a tightly confined navigational area.
Does the 17th District Commander provide your unit with any directives or guidance regarding operational procedures, training of personnel, or port safety?
As it relates to VTS operations?
That's correct, yes.
Not specifically, no. Overall guidance for some of the functions that the VTS can get involved in, but not specific guidance, no.
So as far as the VTS is concerned, all the decisions on policy are at the discretion of this commanding officer of MSO Valdez?
Within the parameters of the regulations that the VTS is based on, yes.
The next area I'm going into is the chain of command at the MSO. Earlier, in response to questioning from Mr. Kacharian, you discussed briefly the chain of command structure. Would you please describe to me how the command structure is for the VTS, who is the operations officer, and who are subordinates right on down to the vessel traffic controllers?
Myself as the commanding officer, and then followed under me is the executive officer, Lieutenant Commander Falkenstein. Under the executive officer is Lieutenant James Rice, the operations officer. Under him is Senior Chief Bruce Moores. And then under him we have RD1, Radarman First Class, James Moore, who is the senior watch stander. And then we have our three GS9 civilians and my other three radar watch standers. Other two radar watch standers, I'm sorry.
What is the lowest level that policy can be developed and implemented under that structure?
You're referring to that memo, basically, that in 1987?
That the memorandum that Commander McCall is referring to is 7C and 7D. The first one I was going to refer to, Commander, was 7C. Mm-hmm. And signed by Mr. R.D. Bruce Moore, where he designates Mr. R.D. One Moore as the leading petty officer. Would that make him the immediate supervisor for the vessel traffic controllers?
Yes.
Is Mr. Moore able to make policy for the VTC?
No.
I draw your attention to Exhibit 7D, 7 Delta. Now, could you look at paragraph 2?
Yes.
This is a memorandum. Would you interpret that paragraph for me and tell me, in your opinion, is Mr. Moore issuing policy here?
No, he's not issuing policy. He is interpreting policy that was established at a higher level. He's just putting into words to explain to the watchstanders what we intend to do within the actual plotting of vessel traffic in Valdez Narrows.
Could you get into a little more detail on how this policy came about?
Yes. In the summer of 1977 was when the personnel reduction cuts that we mentioned earlier were taking place. We still had extra people at the unit then, although some of their billets, their assignments were being done away with. Some of the people were still here. They hadn't moved on yet. So we were looking at it as a period of flux to see how well the unit would operate with this upcoming reduction of personnel. So we were making modifications to the operation in anticipation of the reduced manning and the increased workload on others, and the perceived need for what the VTS needed to do. And it was the general consensus and overall opinion of everybody that the physical plotting or document record keeping of transits out beyond Valdez Narrows was no longer necessary, was unnecessary. They had been doing, since 1977, when the VTS first started, the watchstanders were physically plotting, transits of vessels in and out from whenever the radar first picked them up to whenever the radar lost them. Since 1977, there was a change out of radars. New radars were in with more capabilities to track, monitor vessel traffic. There was a general consensus that the recording of plot data was no longer necessary outside Valdez Narrows, and we could operate safely and satisfactorily without recording the transits, but that no way reduced the vigilance of the watchstander in monitoring the vessel transits out. Monitoring being a combination of radio communications and radar utilization.
When you mentioned that they were actually plotting years ago on a chart, and isn't that a little bit different than just recording the data when you talk about plotting the way it is today?
Well, the old radar systems did not have the automatic course and speed plotting capability that the Raytheons have. So there was no way to acquire that data other than the radar operator manipulating it manually, logging it in, and plotting it. The system we have now, that data is available, and a chartlet can be recreated at a later date if the need arises. So it relieved the watchstander from the burden of having to put the pen to paper, so to speak, and develop a chart. It also alleviated him from, or allowed him to spend more time at the radar scope and less time away from the radar scope trying to do plotting. It actually improved the vigilance of the watchstander.
But wasn't the purpose of actually plotting a target to determine at what part of the traffic separation scheme or what part of the Valdez arm the vessel was located versus historical data?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Let me rephrase the question. Are you not saying that when you take the range and bearing of a vessel outbound in Valdez Arm, that today you're just recording it in a logbook versus what you did before by actually plotting the position of the vessel on a chartlet?
Yes.
Are you saying that the new Raytheon system, that the watchstander knows exactly where that vessel is at all times just by looking at the scope?
Yes, he uses the automatic acquisition capabilities of the Raytheon radar to visually observe his transit out.
But the automatic acquisition just gives the course and speed, is that correct? Range and bearing, course and speed?
Yes, range and bearing, course and speed, and it's visually observed on the screen. He can see it.
If the vessel is in the vicinity of Busby Island, for example, mm-hmm. by just looking at the screen, can you tell whether a vessel is in the outbound lane or the separation zone? Can you tell just by looking at it?
Can I myself or?
The watchstander.
Yeah, the watchstanders can. Some of them prefer to use the overlay. Some of them don't use the overlay, depending on personal preference or congestion in the system.
You mentioned the overlay. Is the overlay commonly used, or is this a feature that is occasionally used?
I'd say depending on the congestion in the system, it may or may not be used routinely by the watchstander.
Is there a policy requiring watchstanders to use the overlay?
No.
Do you know whether any of the other Coast Guard VTSs actually plot vessels?
I don't believe the other VTSs plot vessels on a routine basis.
Since the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, are you currently using the overlay all the time?
The majority of the time, I'd say yes.
Have there been any modifications to the overlay?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
I would like to call your attention, Commander, to Exhibit 7A Alpha. Paragraph 4.26, plotting requirements. When I read this paragraph, it creates a certain amount of confusion with me. Would you care to take a look at it and give us your interpretation?
Mr. Johnson, what page was that, please?
Page 20, pardon me.
Thank you.
Vessels transiting the one-way zone through Valdez Narrows are plotted using the Raytheon data logger at three-minute intervals in Valdez Narrows only. Outside the Narrows, they just use the automatic acquisitioning tracking mechanism within the radar and visually plot them using that acquisition until the radar contact is lost.
Now, from the definition of plotting that you gave us before using the data logger, doesn't that second to last sentence, the plotting intervals outside the Valdez Narrows of 6 minutes, wouldn't that lead one to believe that you would also be plotting outside of the Narrows?
For the uninformed, yes, it would.
When did this vessel traffic manual, when was it updated?
It was updated in November of 88. The prior manual of 1986 had a lot of inaccuracies in it, the major one being the vessel traffic watch officer, which no longer existed as a result of personnel reductions. So the operations department rewrote and reworked up this manual, and it was signed in November of 88. It's a living document, that's how I refer to it. It is and should be under constant evaluation, constant flux. If a watchstander has a problem with something, he brings it out and we can make modifications to it.
So as far as you're concerned, the term plotting was just an incorrect term that was used in this particular instruction?
I think looking at it, it could be construed to be incorrect, yes. The watchstanders and the personnel are aware of what is required for this section.
So even though this was a November 88 update, it would not supersede the memo by Mr. Morse?
No, the memos were incorporated. The content or the intent of the memos were incorporated into the 1988 publication.
Would you, I'd like to call your attention to page 21, same exhibit, 7 Alpha. Paragraph 4.33. Paragraph A. It states here that the intention of a vessel moving or intending to move within the VTS area shall be assumed to be in compliance with the TSS rules unless the vessel specifically requests a deviation. Could you explain that for me, please? How would you interpret this?
The word assume, basically?
How would you, is that the assumption that the watchstanders make, that if all vessels that are transiting the TSS are assumed to be in compliance with the TSS rules?
Yes, we don't have radar coverage throughout Prince William Sound. We have radio communications throughout the sound and beyond. In the areas where there are no radar coverage, basically, generally speaking, south of the Bligh Island, Bligh Reef Buoy area, we have to rely on the integrity of the vessel operators to adhere to the traffic separation scheme.
So therefore, you require 100% cooperation and participation in order for the system to work?
For those participating vessels, yes.
In that same paragraph, it makes a mention to a vessel specifically requesting a deviation. And I know we had a discussion with Commander Waldron earlier this week about the definition of deviating and departing. I wonder if you could clarify, when a vessel requests a deviation, what does that mean?
Well, a deviation is something other than the norm, other than the normal operating parameters within the traffic separation scheme.
So a vessel would be deviating if it left the traffic separation scheme, the TSS? Is that correct?
If it totally left the system, other than to cross out, there's within the guidelines, within the regulations, vessels are permitted to cross into and leave the traffic separation scheme to either go to an anchorage, divert, other than tankers now, divert and go off to Whittier or to Cordova or to other places. So there are those, those deviations or departures of the traffic lane are well within the permitted allowances. To go outside of the lane or go out of the system to pass another tanker or to do something else would be major deviations.
Are vessels permitted to deviate from the lanes in the vicinity of Valdez Arm?
Not without contacting the Vessel Traffic Center. Well, any deviation, they should be contacting the VTC to let us know what they're doing, what's going on. Whether it's basically just so all the vessels in the system, we know where everybody is and what they're doing.
We were just talking a moment ago about there are portions of the sound which you really cannot see a vessel, and you can only rely on their voluntary participation. What if a vessel decides to deviate across the lanes and leave the TSS without the watchstander seeing them?
And without the vessel contacting us on radio? Then you're correct. We would not see that happening.
Would you call the transit of the Exxon Valdez from the southbound lane across the separation zone through the northbound lane and out of the traffic separation scheme a deviation?
Yes, I would.
Did the Exxon Valdez ever have permission to deviate from the traffic separation scheme?
Totally leave the separation scheme?
That's correct.
No, they never requested permission to leave the separation and to leave the system completely.
Commander, what is the extent of the radar coverage from the Potato Point site?
It varies with weather conditions and the operation of the equipment itself.
Excuse me, Mr. John, can you give a range?
A range? Okay. I'd say anywhere from 8 to 20 miles.
8 to 20 miles? Have you personally ever observed a vessel picked up at 20 miles from the Potato Point site?
Yes. Yesterday, as a matter of fact. No, not yesterday, Thursday.
This was an inbound or outbound vessel?
I believe it was an inbound vessel.
If that is the case, how can you explain why the watchstanders on the night of the 23rd were unable to pick up the Exxon Valdez in the vicinity of Busby Island?
Well, as I said, ranges were from 8 to 20. There's some days when we lose them at that 8-mile, in fact, even 6-mile range. So it's well within the realm of possibilities that he could have lost a reliable image, reliable fix at that point.
Under the conditions that prevail in Prince William Sound, what would you say the radar coverage is on a daily basis, on average, during the course of the year?
Well, since the casualty, we've been keeping, at your request, we've been keeping records of, or accumulating data for transits in and out. And I think for the month of April, I think the average coverage was about 14 miles.
You're listening to Commander Steve McCall testifying at the National Transportation Safety Board hearing in Anchorage. This coverage is brought to you by KSK Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
What do you mean by, you mean the scale on the radar itself?
Well, they indicated that they're on the 6-mile scale. Mm-hmm. Is that why they didn't pick up the Exxon Valdez?
No, the radar operator indicated that he attempted to acquire him on the 12-mile range, 12-mile scale, and was unable to.
Which operator are you referring to?
Mr. Taylor.
And he didn't pick up the Exxon Valdez on the 12-mile scale?
I think that's what he said, yes.